Welcome to the Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brook Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays read by Leighton Pugh.
Nordic and Baltic countries prepare scenarios of war. Charlie Salonius Pasternak. Thinking about war in our time and our region is no longer an activity restricted to historians or military planners. Politicians and citizens in the countries bordering the Baltic Sea have been forced to accept that it has become necessary to prepare for an unwelcome guest: war. In 2013 to 2014, the percentage of Finns who thought it likely or very likely that Finland would be threatened militarily during the next decade increased from 7% to 21%. If war seeks us out, what might it look like and will we be ready? One way to address this is through scenario planning. The scenarios can be concrete or conceptual. Both enable us better to understand how warfare of the mind, surprise and awe, or the terme du jour, hybrid war, may play out. If you look at the career path of a Finnish soldier who completed his one-year conscription service in 1983, it would have coincided with the last escalatory spiral of the Cold War. Intermediate-range nuclear missiles in Europe and the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, were on everyone's lips. He would have participated in military exercises that revolved around territorial defense. 6 years later, as a recent graduate of the cadet school and a newly minted senior lieutenant, he would scarcely have believed that the Cold War had ended while he was in school, seemingly taking with it the threat of nuclear Armageddon. He would have had to cancel all leave and prepare for possible refugees, as news of the coup attempt in Moscow and the Soviet Union's dissolution became public. Focus remained on territorial defense, but the likelihood that it would be needed was decreasing. In the mid-1990s, as a captain, he could have been among the first Finns to participate in a NATO-led operation in the Balkans. By this time, the threat of a continental war in Europe ending in the use of nuclear weapons had become a remote concept, to say the least. The popular image of war was dominated by civil conflict, whether in Africa or the Balkans, a mixture of intra- and inter-state war that was conceptually and practically different from the big war that most of Europe had been preparing for during the Cold War. Peacekeeping and crisis management had begun to replace big war as activities that Western militaries were being tasked with or asked to prepare for. The young captain would have heard his fellow officers from NATO countries reflect on talk about out-of-area or out-of-business peacekeeping operations becoming the primary task for the armed forces of NATO members. He would, however, have returned to Finland to continue training conscripts to defend their country. By 2009, promoted to colonel, he would have served in Afghanistan, where counterinsurgency and its associated capabilities had become de rigueur, primarily all volunteer forces, often with little experience of civilian life. They would seek to win the hearts and minds of civilians in Afghanistan. Sitting by himself in a tent in Camp Marmal in northern Afghanistan, he might have jotted down some thoughts about how the strongest military alliance in the world was indeed becoming more interoperable, but was ultimately learning the wrong game. Preparations for collective defense in Europe were still seen as optional. Today, this Finnish soldier, now wearing the lion insignia of a general, could observe that the kind of war much of the West has engaged in changes frequently, and at a pace faster than our capabilities can develop. Larger countries may have adapted to continuously changing goals and paths of development in the past, but even they are stretched now, smaller countries like Finland even more so. The general could reflect on the fact that throughout his career and in the face of all advice and peer pressure, Finland has continued to focus on existential military threats to the nation, on building and maintaining a modern territorial defence, and a societal deep security. Together, these form the basis of a fairly robust defence against war, though not, of course, a nuclear one. The obvious rejoinder is to ask, what kind of war? I will leave the task of precisely defining war to more experienced hands. Rather, my aim is to open up some thinking regarding what war in our time and in our region might look like. To do this, I'm going to present a few possible scenarios. First, to grasp this from the Finnish perspective, it is necessary to understand that there is a clear division within Finland as to how war is seen. In general, the political establishment sees war as distinct and rare. While this is not quite a binary peace-war division, there is a clear sense that, to adapt Larry Flint, they know war when they see it, which is good, since it's ultimately their decisions to mobilize or react to military aggression that we rely upon. The reality is, of course, nothing like that, as can be seen from the reaction to a 2009 op-ed piece I wrote in Helsingin Sanomat, where I argued that Finland was party to a war in Afghanistan. Within hours of publication, both the defence and foreign ministers in Finland had been dragged out of meetings to denounce the idea on television, the defence minister saying there was no factual basis for such a statement, and the foreign minister going further, saying it was irresponsible even to make the suggestion. Other contributors to this book may have a rather different view on whether a war was going on in Afghanistan in 2009. Fortunately, much of the military recognizes war as a regular feature of our time. Information operations in the form of well-placed articles, interviews, and statements, the intentional violation of national borders in the air and potentially under the sea, and procurement of property by Russian actors near every significant Finnish military base are certainly not as clear as Russian tanks rolling across the border in eastern Ukraine, but neither are they the sign of peaceful neighbourly relations. This latter view of the frequency and unclear nature of war dovetails nicely with the approach that has become the term du jour, hybrid or non-linear war. Instead of going into a long discussion about the provenance of the term and its evolution during the past few years, I refer to a recent report by András Ratz from the Finnish Institute of International Affairs, in which he identifies five prerequisites for a successful hybrid war of the kind Russia has employed in Ukraine. First, Russia must be militarily stronger than the country it attacks. The credibility of a conventional attack must exist as a deterrent. Second, there must be lasting, regionally concentrated dissatisfaction with the central government. Third, the presence of a large Russian-speaking minority is required as a source of a potential legitimacy. Fourth, there needs to be media superiority both in the target country and internationally. Fifth, logistics requires either a legitimate presence of Russian forces nearby, Sevastopol Naval Base in Crimea, or that the territory has a border with Russia, where the border control is weak, i.e. eastern Ukraine. If one takes these five prerequisites into consideration, it is relatively easy to argue that Finland is not likely to be threatened by a hybrid war of this kind. Such an argument for Finnish structural security is based on four components. First, there is a fundamental strength to a society built upon democracy, rule of law, universal education, relative socio-economic equality, and freedom of speech. The Fund for Peace Fragile States Index, which uses over 100 social, political, and economic indicators, has ranked Finland as the most sustainable and least fragile state in every year from 2011 to 2015. Second, there is a broad concept of security, with Finland's defence capability making up only one of seven vital functions of society that the government has identified in successive security reviews. Third, Finland has built up a dense security cooperation network, seeking to ensure that irrespective of the kind of security challenge it is faced with, suitable partners can be found and relied upon, whether from among other states, the private or third sectors. Fourth, as described above, Finland has maintained and continues to modernize a functioning national defense system. The form of hybrid warfare we've seen so far may not be that effective, but what we will see are different versions of it, with each new iteration and case requiring a mixture of different ingredients. For now, the two other conceptual approaches to warfare that seem most relevant, warfare of the mind and surprise and awe, demand some deeper thought from a Finnish and Nordic perspective. Warfare of the mind, an extension of reflexive control that includes cyber, information, diplomatic, political, and non-military physical actions, is continuously aimed at Finland by Russia, though sometimes Finland is not the main target, just in the firing line. In any case, it is real, has an impact, and is cost-effective. I will come back to surprise and awe after describing two concrete scenarios that serve as possible examples of what war in our time and in our region may look like. The scenarios presented below were among several composed with two colleagues, James Mashiri and Mikael Moberi, and written up in the Finnish weekly Suomen Kuvalehti in February 2015. Each scenario falls in the category between expected events, such as airspace violations, and speculative ones, such as a Third World War. I've picked two, one regarding Gotland and one Finland. Gotland is an island that has figured heavily in Swedish discussions about security and defence policy. The scenario starts with an increasingly tense security situation in the Baltic Sea region and envisions an operation beginning with the elimination of the Hemvärnet Home Guard leadership, destruction of pre-positioned vehicles, tanks, and the downing of a JAS Gripen sent over Gotland on a reconnaissance mission, all ostensibly by the newly formed armed forces of the Gotland Folkrepublik. Diverse terrorist actions causing societal instability on the mainland follow, and the next day, Russian air and seaborne troops land on Gotland. Swedish attempts to stave off the landings are only partially successful, as the Swedish Defence Forces are still too oriented towards international crisis management operations. Soon, S-400s and Pantsir S-1 air defence systems make flying over large parts of the Baltic Sea dangerous. Finnish politicians must consider whether to let Sweden use Finnish facilities and capabilities to intercept additional Russian military units. The purpose of the scenario was to highlight the immediate military and political demands, such as sudden escalation would place on Finnish political decision-making. When published, the major criticism of the scenario was that it wouldn't make any sense for Russia to do this, or that it could not keep Gotland in the long term. While the latter would be true, we challenge the former criticism. Something making sense assumes a potential adversary's goals, aims, and logic are similar to your own, a perfect case of mirror imaging. Is this scenario likely? No, it was not meant to be a prediction of the future. Is it conceivable? Yes, and based on a lot of thinking around the subject. Is it more likely now than 5 years ago? Absolutely. The second scenario we sketched out related to the Åland Islands, a demilitarized archipelago that has significant autonomy but falls under Finland's sovereignty. The initial demilitarization was the result of the Crimean War in the 1850s. Its status was set by the League of Nations in 1921, when an agreement to neutralize the islands was also established. The Soviet Union and its successor, Russia, however, have never agreed to neutrality in war. The scenario begins with increasing threats and actual attacks on Russian energy infrastructure in the Bay of Finland. Russia eventually announces that it has been forced to seek stronger control of maritime areas because Western-supported actors are trying to strangle Russian energy exports. Potential sightings of sea mines provide Russia with an excuse to move ships close to Finnish borders, and Russia suggests that Finnish minesweeper ships stay in harbour. The Finnish government is unwilling to enact emergency laws for fear of further escalating the situation, a decision which delays and ultimately thwarts appropriate and timely defensive measures by the Finnish military. In the end, Russia argues that the threats it sees are unlikely to be short-term, and the Finnish government is given an ultimatum regarding the need to establish a shared naval base. This scenario was also criticised, mainly because Finnish political decision-makers were thought to be too passive, and that Russia would not be willing to stage such an elaborate play to manufacture a threat to its strategic energy infrastructure, nor would it be ready to threaten the use of military force simply to gain a military base. The relative passivity of the government in the scenario is supported by insights gained from diverse sources. Simply threatening use of force to gain the upper hand in political negotiations is something we continue to see. Is this scenario likely? No. Is it conceivable? Yes, and more so than Gotland. Is it more likely now than 5 years ago? Absolutely. The obvious question is, why would Russia do anything like this? The shortest possible answer is to ensure its sphere of influence and weaken that of the EU and, if possible, NATO. Of course, if it can achieve this sphere of influence, along with a politically, economically, and militarily weakened Europe, without resorting to military force, all the better. Sometimes the threat of military force can get an opponent to make a favourable decision without the need for direct action. These scenarios and the lead-up to them have one common element, that we be taken by surprise. And this is perhaps the greatest asset that Russia has in any scenario. Too many people in Finland and Sweden are not willing to accept how well or how often surprise has worked in history. Because this concept of surprise is so central to the possibility of war in our time, in our region, I will explain its relevance briefly. To do so, I will borrow from work by two retired colonels, Bo Hugemark from Sweden and Anders Gardberg from Finland. Anders was Finnish defence attaché in Stockholm until 2014 and is now head of Saab Defence in Finland. The key point is that for a variety of reasons, political decision-makers actually don't recognise war until it is too late. The view in Sweden of Russia's frequent readiness exercises, violations of sovereignty, and aggressive strike exercises is that they are simply the new normal. The idea that all of these actions have become commonplace has also impacted military intelligence, rendering old warning indicators largely invalid. Previously, the expectation was that Finnish military intelligence would provide ample time and unambiguous evidence about the upcoming use of force. Neither of these expectations holds now. Russia can make continuous preparations for the use of force and then launch it directly out of peacetime control positions. This means that the period of warning that intelligence services can provide is reduced and that the evidence is likely to be ambiguous. Moreover, it is highly probable that while making its own preparations, Russia would exert political and diplomatic pressure to try to forestall and delay mobilization by its opponents. Even if Finnish politicians were to decide to raise levels of national readiness, there are limits to how long a small country can maintain a heightened state of alert. In this respect, Sweden is probably even worse off. The more limited resources of small countries mean that even when warning signs have been accepted, it is possible that actual mobilization occurs too late. Though not a trait unique to Finland and Sweden, we also have a well-established track record of happily deceiving ourselves. For example, as happened in the response to our hypothetical scenario, saying that Russia doesn't have the capability to do X and arguing that it wouldn't make sense or that Russia wouldn't benefit from conflict may in itself serve as a red flag to outside observers. We're also not great at estimating the risks a potential attacker is willing to take, since we frequently don't know what the final goal may be, and, generally speaking, we're pretty happy with our lives. We would prefer not to anticipate war. All of this is likely to lead to the kinds of delay in raising readiness that are described in our scenarios. Combine this with a tendency by those willing to use military force for political ends to produce a fait accompli, Adolf Hitler, Saddam Hussein, Vladimir Putin, and it becomes easier to see how surprise and awe must be considered a compelling approach to warfare in our time and in our region. A surprise use of conventional force, coupled with a sudden demand for nuclear de-escalation and immediate economic pressure, would present a potent challenge to Finland. Here, it must be explained that under current Russian military thinking, nuclear de-escalation means that Russia can present the opposing side with an ultimatum that ends or freezes the conflict, or in which Russia uses tactical nuclear weapons. A barrage of cyber operations, information campaigns, and electronic warfare would all be used to delay, confuse, and otherwise impact decision makers who might ultimately be faced with a choice about where, on one side of the scale, national survival lies, and on the other, a temporary and self-imposed limitation on sovereignty, such as not joining NATO. Is this flexible sovereignty, agreeing to a temporary shared naval base or denying others the use of Finnish airspace, worth the risk of jeopardizing the long-term future of Finland? Looking at recent events, it is because actors in our region answer these questions over sovereignty differently that we may yet see the arrival of an unwelcome guest. War in our time and in our region.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.